In a world of Democrats,
there will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
And Republicans,
I've abandoned free market principles to save the free market system.
You need a voice of liberty. Look no further. You found it. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome to the Tom Woods Show, episode 372. Today, by popular demand, I'm talking about the Indiana Religious Freedom Restoration Act that's been at the center of so much controversy in recent days. I'm finally getting to this subject. There were a number of guests I could have invited on, but I decided, what the heck, I think I'll try and handle this one myself. So what I'd like to do is give some background and context to this at the beginning, and then at the end, say something more generally about anti-discrimination law and government. And I'm relying for some of the background or information on a very useful article that I will link to on the show notes page, which of course will be tomwoods.com/372, written by Josh Blackman, who is a law professor in Texas and who has an article in National Review. And National Review, as you folks know, is not a source I consult a whole lot, but I have to admit, I'll give credit where it's due, that this is a very useful article, not so much for the opinions in it, because it really isn't an opinion piece, as much as it is for the historical background, providing the context behind this law. It's not just that one day Indiana decided to come up with a law that a lot of Americans would find obnoxious, and they did it for no good reason and completely out of the blue. That's absolutely false. So I want to go through this bit by bit. The Indiana law that has caused so much controversy is actually modeled on a 1993 U.S. government law with the same name, Religious Freedom Restoration Act. It's been adopted more or less in more or less similar form in 19 other states, and the Obama Justice Department and four federal courts of appeals have more or less taken the position that is at the center of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which is, and this is the area of controversy, that this act can be used as a defense in private suits, that is, in suits that in which neither party is a governmental entity, private suits that involve the enforcement of laws that substantially burden the free exercise of religion. Now, the story of this act, of the federal law, goes all the way back to 1990 and the case of Alfred Smith. So Alfred Smith is engaged in American Indian religious ceremonies, which involve ingesting peyote, which of course is a hallucinogen, and he lost his job. Well, then he goes to get his unemployment benefits, and he's denied on the basis of the drug use. And so he claims that this is an attack on his free exercise of religion. The courts do not uphold this, but it was in response to his case that the Religious Freedom Restoration Act at the federal level was established. Now, now here's what's interesting about this. When you read this act, you see how vague the whole thing is. And this is a problem with government and its made-up rights and its screwed-up understanding of rights, that it makes up some rights, and then these wind up in conflict with one another, so it makes up more rights, and the whole thing becomes very murky and difficult to follow. You don't know, well, am I allowed to do this or not? There are 28 relevant statutes. Am I allowed to do this thing or am I not allowed to do this thing? This is why private property is so important and so wonderful as a deciding factor in social conflict. Because private property would say, well, this is up to the employer and the employee to decide. They can decide whether or not this is a legitimate practice. And if both parties don't believe it is, then they sever the relationship, and that's the end of it. Because you don't have any property right in a job. You're not entitled to a job. You have that on the basis of the consent of both parties, you and the employer. Of course, unemployment benefits would be entirely, unless there was some kind of private insurance for that, that would be entirely ruled out in a free society. But and so you wouldn't have this problem in the first place. But anyway, the law says that the federal government shall not substantially burden a person's exercise of religion unless it is in furtherance of a compelling governmental interest and is the least restrictive means of furthering that compelling governmental interest. You got that? You're going to make sense of that? That's the basis of your rights in many cases. It's you have to fall back on religious freedom, and the government will figure out if burdening your religious freedom is important enough to it that it's going to allow itself to get away with it. Fairly convoluted, but that's the weak read of this whole Religious Freedom Restoration Act. Then we got the Supreme Court case involving Hobby Lobby using the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. It came to the conclusion that the federal government could not force Hobby Lobby to offer health insurance to its employees that included contraceptive coverage. But what remained unclear, and this is the context for the Indiana law, what remained unclear is, does the Religious Freedom Restoration Act apply only in cases involving the government? With Alfred Smith, he was suing the government because the case had to do with unemployment benefits. The Hobby Lobby case involved a government program being forced on Hobby Lobby. But could the Religious Freedom Restoration Act be appealed to in cases brought by entirely private parties? Could I, as a private party, have recourse to the Religious Freedom Restoration Act when another private party comes to me and tries to enforce a federal law against me? It's not the government. It's a private party. That's the question. Now, most circuit courts that have spoken on this have concluded that, yes, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act extends, in the defense that it allows, to cases in which a private party comes at you and says, I'm going to enforce such and such against you. You are allowed to defend yourself on the basis of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. So even if it's not the Justice Department coming after you, even if it's not a government agency coming after you, if it's a private party using a federal law, for example, an anti-discrimination law against you, you can appeal to the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. That's what most judicial rulings have concluded on this subject. Now, in the article that I'm going to be linking you to at tomwoods.com/372, there are a number of examples of this to help make this clear. I'll give you an example, give you a couple of examples. We'll talk about the New Mexico case also. In 2005, the Second Circuit Court of Appeals heard a case involving a clergyman of the New York Methodist Church, and this clergyman had been forced into retirement at age 70. And there are different churches have different rules on this. I know that Catholic churches, when it comes to bishops, there's a retirement rule at 75, unless it's waived by the Vatican. It's assumed that you're going to retire at age 75. Well, here you had a clergyman being forced into retirement at age 70, and so he brings an anti-discrimination claim against the New York Methodist Church, an age discrimination claim. And the church comes back with, well, this would burden our free exercise of religion. So here you have two entirely private parties, a clergyman and the New York Methodist Church, no government involved. And the Second Circuit Court of Appeals ruled against this clergyman, saying that, yes, it is perfectly okay for this church to have its own rules regarding retirement, and that is part of its free exercise of religion. So in other words, here was a case with a circuit court saying that the Religious Freedom Restoration Act does allow a defendant like the New York Methodist Church to use that act in its defense in a case in which only private parties are involved. Now, there is a minority position, however, that's held by a minority of judges that claims that the Religious Freedom Restoration Act applies or can apply only in cases involving the government directly. When the government comes after you, then you can use the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. But when a private party comes after you and simply appeals to a federal law, some kind of anti-discrimination law, then you can't. Or if it's a state-level Religious Freedom Restoration Act where there's still this ambiguity, and let's say you've got anti-discrimination law in the state and you're accused of discrimination, you can't, according to this more narrow reading, use the Religious Freedom Restoration Act as a defense in your discrimination case. And the classic case of this occurred in New Mexico. And it turns out it was one of my old friends from Harvard, whom I've stayed in contact with from time to time over the years, who actually represented the photographers in the case. It was a group of photographers who had refused to take photographs of a lesbian wedding. Now, in a private property society, that'd be the end of it. Okay, they don't want to do it. And in a civilized society, only if both parties want to have an interaction with each other does that interaction take place. Only if two parties want to engage in an exchange does the exchange take place. That's how civilized people act. But uncivilized people then go and try and get a gun to point at photographers or anybody else to force them to engage in commerce with them. And of course, it always occurred to me, if somebody really didn't want to do something for me, I generally wouldn't want to force them to, right? And isn't that just how you were raised? Like, why would I do that? Why would I want to make people, if I knew people didn't want me around, I would feel weird being around. Like, it may be the worst injustice in the history of mankind that they don't want me around because I am such a pleasant person and fun to be with. But if they didn't, I just can't imagine forcing myself on them, you know, or propagandizing them about what a great person I am. I just can't imagine ever thinking that that would be the thing to do. Well, the New Mexico Supreme Court ruled in the narrow tradition of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, saying that you cannot appeal to that in your defense when a private party comes at you in a case like this. This private party was accusing these photographers of discrimination. They could not say, well, look, our religious beliefs simply do not allow us to participate in this because we are opposed to these types of relationships. They can't do it. And so they lost the case. The Supreme Court declined to review that case. There was a possibility that it might have. So now we get to the point of the Indiana law. The Indiana law is trying to clarify this ambiguity about, do these Religious Freedom Restoration Acts, do they apply in cases involving private parties only? New Mexico was finding that they did not. Indiana is finding that they do. This is a long-standing controversy going back 2.5 decades. This is not just, well, a bunch of bigots in Indiana came up with some law. That is not what's going on. There's simply a clarification of some legislation. Now, the wisdom of the legislation is another matter. We'll get to that in a minute. But I do want to point out here that the law does not just simply say, well, people can engage in discrimination without any fear of reprisal or legal recourse against them. It does not say that. What it says is that if they are accused of discrimination, they can base their defense, at least partly, on the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. That doesn't mean they're going to be successful. Their basis, they're using the Religious Freedom Restoration Act in this way, may be rejected. They may lose the case. They're not guaranteed to win, so it's not a license to discriminate. Although, again, I don't see that there's any problem with people saying, I don't want to interact with you. The whole point of freedom is that people are not forced to do things they don't want to do. And if somebody doesn't want to do something for somebody else, and there's no contract between them saying that they have to, I don't see what the problem is in saying, I don't want to do it. That's what freedom is. Freedom is not being able to demand that somebody, for example, bake you a cake. There is absolutely no freedom involving forcing someone to bake you a cake. Like, I can't even state the proposition in a way that doesn't use the word forcing. I can't even think of how you would state that proposition that doesn't use the word forcing. If you're using the word forcing, or it's completely impossible not to use the word forcing in advancing your proposition, then it probably doesn't involve the expansion of freedom. Having cakes baked for you, I suppose you could say that without using the word forcing, but forcing is lurking in the background in brackets. Also, it's worth noting, this is from the National Review article, Daniel Konkol is an Indiana University law professor who supports same-sex marriage. And here's what he says. The proposed Indiana Religious Freedom Restoration Act would provide valuable guidance to Indiana courts, directing them to balance religious freedom against competing interests under the same legal standard that applies throughout most of the land. It is anything but a license to discriminate, and it should not be mischaracterized or dismissed on that basis, unquote. Well, that's very interesting, too, because, of course, we don't hear that perspective in the way it's being covered or in social media and in some of the hysteria over it. Now, having explained all this, I guess I would weigh in this way. I would say that this is what happens when you abandon private property as the deciding factor in so many of these controversies. Private property resolves conflict after conflict after conflict. When you're talking about freedom of speech, for example, you don't really have an abstract, free-floating, so-called freedom of speech, because you most certainly cannot come into my home or business and harangue me about Scientology, about your religion, about your political perspective, about your musical tastes. You don't have the right to come in and shout obscenities at me. Why not? Why not? Because I'm a censor? Because I believe in censorship? No, because it's my property, and I have the right to lay down the rules on my property. So there, that resolves all disputes over freedom of speech. When you're on my property, you can say what I allow you to say. And if you break that rule, you leave my property. And you can go say anything you want on your own property or on the property of people who are more indulgent than I am, but you absolutely don't have a right to property, to a freedom of speech on somebody else's property. That would be invasion. You'd be invading somebody else's property and behaving against the will of that person and violating the property rights of that person. Same thing with the shouting fire in a crowded theater. Rothbard talks about this. He's not the first one. He talks about this in The Ethics of Liberty. A lot of people say, well, we have to make an exception to freedom of speech. We can't have absolute freedom of speech. We have to balance it against the public interest or whatever. No, you can have absolute freedom of speech as long as you understand that it's bounded by private property rights. It has to be. And then that resolves the whole shouting fire in a crowded theater thing. Because the question becomes, whose theater is it? Hello? Whose theater is it? Who's the property owner? That person probably has a rule against creating a commotion that would lead to people getting crushed and injured. Problem solved. Private property resolves the controversy. Well, likewise with this. Of course, conservatives now who rightly fear what's coming, and we all know what's coming. What's coming is churches are going to be forced to perform same-sex weddings. And all the libertarians who are so excited about same-sex marriage and very, very, very mildly concerned about what is obviously going to happen to people who dissent are not really going to be up in arms against that. That's my prediction. That's my prediction. But in fact, there is ample precedent for this elsewhere in the world, as we've seen. And it seems quite likely that churches will be penalized and called discriminators and whatever else, even though they're not violating anybody's rights. You don't have a right to be married in a particular church. You don't. There is no such right anywhere. So the churches will be standing up for their absolutely legitimate libertarian rights. Absolutely 1,000% legitimate. And we can easily see them being attacked on the grounds of discrimination. Especially given the movement of public opinion here. We've got a whole lot of clueless young people who know nothing about what rights are all about, the definition of rights, private property. They know nothing about that. All they know is fashionable social views. That's what they know. And that it's fashionable to have this particular view about same-sex marriage. But they don't know anything about rights. They don't know anything about consent. They know nothing about this. So it is very easy to imagine that that's the direction things are going. And some conservatives are trying to stop that through this incredibly clumsy and awkward means. Because when you notice when I was quoting from this law, it's incredibly awkward, the language. We have to balance religious freedom with whatever. So who even knows how these cases will come out? Well, we've balanced it, and we think that 53% of this is the right to be married in a church, and 47% of it is your right to freedom of religion and running your church however you want. So 53 to 47, this couple wins. I mean, what? What is that? How can you run a society on the basis of that? That's completely arbitrary legalese. That's ruled by judges. Who wants to live in a society like that? But, of course, conservatives cannot go back and say this is a question of private property, because then they know what's going to happen. They're going to be told, oh, you want segregated lunch counters again, and the conservatives will go home crying to their mothers because they don't know how to answer that. Because when push comes to shove, they've given in on the private property question. And, yeah, that's a hard case to make to some people. I understand that. But, obviously, it's no substitute to come up with some law that's so convoluted and that involves balancing all these competing interests, and that as time goes on and public opinion continues to shift in the direction of same-sex marriage, these flimsy laws aren't even going to do you any good. So even watering the whole message down to this point where instead of saying it's my private property and I can do what I want, and instead it's this, well, you know, look, I have some religious beliefs that you have to respect, you water it down to that level, you're not even going to have that. When all is said and done, you're not even going to have that. What it boils down to is, do you believe in forcing people to engage in transactions they don't want to engage in? Do you believe that violence, because that's what this is, this is violence, this is the threat of violence. Do you believe violence is the way to win acceptance? Is that the best way to win acceptance, with threats of violence? Or do you believe that maybe we shouldn't transact with each other if you don't want to? I mean, isn't that something, again, weren't we taught that as kids? If so-and-so doesn't want to play with you, you can't make them. Even though it seems like they should want to play with you. You're wonderful. You haven't done anything to offend them. Why aren't they playing with me? But you can't do that because those people are people too. And they have an integrity that ought not to be compromised. And yes, I mean, nobody wants to live in a society with signs in the window saying so-and-sos can't dine here and whatever. But, I mean, in this day and age, the internet would put a stop to that in 5 seconds. The person would be boycotted out of existence. But on a case-by-case basis, if you just simply don't want to do something, why shouldn't you be able to not do it? And by the way, you should be able to put a sign in your window. There's nothing wrong with putting a sign in your window from a libertarian standpoint. It may be a jerk, the sort of thing that only a jerk would do, but you do have the right to be a jerk. If you didn't have the right to be a jerk, there would be no merit whatsoever in being a moral person if you didn't have the right to choose to be a jerk also. And some people say, look, once I know who the discriminators are, then I'll know where not to spend my money. Well, that's a good point too. But also, for me, the main issue is not the right to, you know, not serve whole classes of people, because I think that's very unlikely that most people would actually want to do that. Most people want to earn money. Most people want to engage in commerce with others that they don't agree with, because what they do agree with is, that person has money he wants to give me, and I want to receive that money. That's grounds for agreement. But these anti-discrimination laws are used not so much because somebody is saying, you know, no Irishman can come into my restaurant. They're used because, let's say, you're running a hotel and you have a group of people, and let's say they're black and they're causing a commotion and they're being extremely inconsiderate and loud and you're getting a lot of complaints from your other customers. Well, what do you do? I mean, can you say, well, look, we have to throw you out. If you're not going to behave properly, we're going to have to throw you out. Well, most hotel operators would be terrified to do this because they know what's going to happen to them. They'll be accused of discrimination. When it has nothing to do with race. These are loud people. I want to get them out. I would get loud white people out of my hotel too. But everybody knows how this works. You are automatically assumed to be a racist and a discriminator, and your livelihood is destroyed and your reputation is destroyed. Or let's say, I gave this as an example in a previous episode, let's say you are cracking down on shoplifters. And let's say that you are throwing people out of your store you suspect of shoplifting, or you've caught shoplifting. And let's say that disproportionately these people belong to minority groups, and that's just the way it turns out. You would be accused of discrimination for asking people to leave your property because they're in the process of stealing things. You would be accused of discrimination, and you would have very little way to defend yourself. But yeah, what am I supposed to do as a store owner? Am I supposed to say, well, you know, I've already thrown out my quota of this race of people this month? What is this? This is insane. And of course, normally you don't want to throw people out of your establishment because you want them to buy things, right? Like, what are the chances that somebody would want to abuse this to the point where they're just throwing paying customers out for no good reason, right? I mean, who would want to do that, especially in this economy? You want every buck you can wheedle out of the public, for heaven's sake. And I think, by the way, think of my own case. I'm Armenian. I'm fully half Armenian. And the Armenians and the Turks have long-standing hatreds between them. Now, I personally have no hatreds toward anybody. I don't have any problem whatsoever with people who are Turks. But I know there are Turks who don't like Armenians, and I know there are a lot of Armenians who don't like Turks. And, of course, you know, there's a really ugly history that involves Armenians and Turks. But the point is, if I went into a Turkish restaurant and they knew I was half Armenian, and they're just sitting there glaring at me the whole time, and they really don't want me there, I don't think I'd go to the Justice Department and say, you know, these people, they don't seem to want me in their restaurant. I think I'd say, you know, I think I'm going to eat somewhere else. And it's a shame that I should have to, but life isn't fair, and there are a lot worse things that could happen to me. I just can't imagine saying, these are people who don't want me on the premises, but I'm going to force myself in here anyway. I don't understand that personality type. But ultimately, if you're going to rest your right to say, look, I don't want to do this for whatever reason, because it violates your religious beliefs, because you're lazy, because whatever, if you're going to try and rest it on this extremely murky type of law, you're not going to get anywhere. You may as well have just stuck with principle all along. And the principle here is, I'm a property owner. I set the rules in my establishment, and if you don't like those rules, you go somewhere else. That's what the market is all about. You find somebody you do agree with. Instead of badgering me into agreeing with you, which is never going to happen, you're not going to badger me into agreeing with you. Instead of trying to do that, instead of sending your armed goons to my establishment, do the civilized thing and say, well, I'm very sorry you feel that way. I think it's outrageous that you feel that way, but I'm going to go patronize this other establishment where my money is good. And then you see where society goes. All right, that's that. It's controversial, but, you know, look, if I were boring, why would you be listening? So if you like this, if you like the show, if you like these sorts of topics, you'll enjoy my new book, Real Dissent, A Libertarian Sets Fire to the Index Card of Allowable Opinion, because we're way off the index card of allowable opinion in this episode. And you get the Kindle edition of that book as one of your gifts and bonuses for becoming a supporting listener of the show. You like this show, you appreciate it, please support it at supportinglisteners.com. You get so many goodies. I don't even have the time to tell them to you. They're just so many darn goodies. Check out the show notes page for this episode, tomwoods.com/372 for that article that I mentioned, and see you tomorrow.
The Tom Woods Show.